Baby eats dog food, or a diagnosis called suffering. Baby comes contemplated eating dog food because Gwyneth Paltrow ate dog food. And she wanted to be skinny, just like Gwynnie. She went to the supermarket late one night in a fit of nerves and tears and jumping jack dreams so she could buy dog food, so she could nibble on kibble and not get fat. What she bought instead was the wet canned kind, which she placed at the center of her plate when she returned home late, and sprinkled some parsley, and dipped some mayo, and squirted some ketchup. "Yum, yum, yum," baby said, licking her lips and chomping her bit. What could be more delicious? She picked up her fork. Great silver spear it was. And dove it into the dog food salad. It landed with a plunk. One. Nerves. Yes, baby had psychiatric problems. Yes, psychiatry is real. Yes, it isn't just pseudoscience. Yes, baby took pills because she liked to eat dog food. And yes, the author would come to take pills too because she came up with the very notion of a baby who liked to eat dog food. It seemed so very sensible, so very obvious. Psychiatry would root out the impurities within the text, within those who receive the text, and with the writers of the text. Psychiatry would render the text perfect, whole, not marked by the desperation of a baby who liked to eat dog food. Or nerves. One. It would take 2 years and 4 trips to the loony bin for a baby to admit, yes, she did indeed need psych meds. This would be another plot line in the story of baby, another plot line in the story of language. What would become of language if not sedated by psychiatry? What grammar broken? What verbs torn? What syntax hung out, dry and bleeding on the plane? It seemed so very sensible, so very obvious. Psychiatry would root out impurities within language, within those who receive language, and it would begin, of course, with the writers of language. It would begin, of course, with baby. Dr. Goodall believed this to her very core. Shh. Don't be scared, Dr. Goodall would say, as she fed baby a tiny pink pill. Two. Ketchup. Pleasure was the thing she feared most of all. Pleasure seemed to come like a tidal wave, consuming her, taking her over. Pleasure. Pleasure. She could hardly imagine herself without a crutch and a cane and a steel cannonball tethered to her ankle. It seemed so natural to walk about the world like an ape, like a cripple in a dunce cap stomping the parched earth. Without her cane, her gnarly nub of leg swinging through this wide world, what else would she do? What else would she be? What else would she become? Plunk! The cartoonish elements of the text bore a striking resemblance to Baby's favorite childhood television show, Ren and Stimpy, which aired at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on Nickelodeon, and featured a strange mixture of working-class imagery, i.e. white trash, and fecal imaginations, i.e. poo-poo, and homoerotic brotherly love, i.e. boy best friends fucking. And Baby loved to watch the show for the pure and simple pleasure that she gathered from the heavy grunting of the characters. Which formed a symphony of Neanderthal noises not dissimilar to the sounds Johnny T. Walker IV would make in years to come as he fucked the living daylights out of Baby. Page 2. Just then, in a flash, Mother scurried into the kitchen and flipped on the lights. Owee! Owee! Mother didn't like to enter Baby stories. Mother didn't like to enter Baby rooms. Mother didn't like to intrude. But there Mother was. Mother, flipping, lights.
What are you doing up at this hour, Baby? I'm eating dog food.
Oh.
Pause.
Can I have some? What are you doing up at this hour, Baby? I'm eating dog food. Oh, pause. Can I have some? What are you doing up at this hour, Baby?
I'm eating dog food.
Oh,
pause.
Can I have some? What are you doing up at this hour, Baby?
I'm eating dog food.
Oh, pause. Can I have some? Baby didn't know what to say. Baby didn't know what to do. She didn't want to give Mother her dog food because dog food was Baby's food. And Baby didn't want to give up Baby food. Baby rocked back and forth, back and forth. Well, let me see. wasn't sure what to do. She wasn't sure what to say. She didn't want to be rude. She didn't want to say no. But she also didn't want to give up. Her doggone delicious dog food. Long silence. The refrigerator starts to hum. Maybe just a little. End of scene. And also the beginning of a rambling, compulsive exposition from which the author can find no trap door. Please bear with her. She doesn't mean to be so circuitous. She doesn't mean to get so unhinged. She wished she could write one clear, clean sentence after another. She wishes her sentences weren't so gosh darn confusing, her mind so gosh darn labyrinthine. She wishes she wrote pure poetry, not prose. She wishes she knew how to break and end lines, end stories like good and proper poets do. Except she didn't. Except she did. Except she didn't. And the poems continued on and on and on, and off and off and off they went, and trotted far down the road of morality, far down the road of sanity, fell off the cliff of her imagination, fell off the cliff of her propriety, towards some place she never ever wanted to go, but found herself somewhere in the dust at the bottom of the canyon, licking her wounds, looking for words, looking for pieces of her own name. She couldn't find it. She couldn't find pieces of her own name. She couldn't find pieces of language. She couldn't find poetry. Where was poetry, she asked. Where was poetry? She couldn't find it. She couldn't find it, and she needed it, but she couldn't find it. And the poems continued, impure and perfect, impure, imperfect, and root canaled. And she continued to write, even though she couldn't, and even when she couldn't. And even when all she had was a stick and some dirt and some coal and the bleeding elbows and scratched knees and broken syllables and torn tendons at the bottom of the earth. Critics, cacophony, polymath. The story ends here, I promise you. There will be no more discussion of gratuitous violence. But is it violence when really it's just bodily, self-inflicted invectives of violence? Is it violence? Is it or isn't it? Who cares? It's ending. I tell you, it's over. I'm saying it's done. There will be no more allusions to eating disorders, no more thick blankets coated with shame, except with creepy, nasty parts, no more stories of bodies wrestling against themselves, no more tricks and ticks about self-abasement and abasement. You'll be spared the rest of the story, which is to say, you'll be spared part two. The undercover story, the bloopers, the edited out bits, the nasty bits. I know you really love or love to hate.
Baby types. Baby, it's first person narration, first person, I promise you, I like a preacher, I like a fisher, I'm trying to like a preacher. Dark fruit gives me pleasure. I get pleasure from dark
It's fair to say there seems to be a lot of edging around the text. There seems to be a lot of edging around Freud or Foucault or whomever. Let's just get on with it. Let's just be real. There's much that can't be said with language. There are places where language can't go. Language can't fix the problems baby wants to fix, which are moral problems, goddammit, which are real problems, not fake problems, not wishy-washy silly problems. Moral problems require action. They require largesse or largeness, or they require a beating heart, the blood, the blood. The blood from which we can never find in words. Food. Five. Baby came into Dr. Goodall's office one day, swimming in fear. She was convinced that she was rotten, detestable. She was convinced she was detestable for creating a world where babies raped babies and babies ate babies and dog food seemed the more nutritious choice than the salad bar at Whole Foods. "What should I do?" Baby cried out. Dr. Goodall crossed her legs, tapped her pen, and gave a small smile. Lithium would be the perfect elixir to fix baby's madness, to strap down her tongue, to strap down her ferocious mind, the mind that controlled the tongue. The tongue which spoke the words which should never, ever be spoken. Psychiatry would render baby perfect, would render her stories perfect, not marked by the desperation of a baby who liked to eat dog food. The end. And if you're get to listen to swift sing a song for baby. What do I do if it's all a performance? If it's all a performance, why are we checking out a fucking celebrity as fucking gorgeous as Taylor Swift?
I don't even fucking know who Taylor Swift is. Like, who is Taylor Swift? Like, who's Taylor Swift? Like, I'm way too fucking intellectual for fucking Taylor Swift. Like, who the fuck is Taylor Swift? Why would I even talk about, like, fucking Taylor Swift if I'm, like, a fucking smart girl? I'm not, like, a retard. Like, I'm not, like, one of those, like, dumb people who, like, is into, like, I don't know, like, People Magazine or whatever. Like, I don't read that shit. Like, don't fucking tell me that I read that shit. Like, ew. I can't even believe that you would even, like, suggest such a thing. But I
Their bodies are dead, slashed, stomachs open, guts spilling out, their bodies splayed over each other like rag dolls. Eres una muñeca, eres una muñeca. Eres una muñeca, eres una muñeca, eres una muñeca. Story 2. Gramsci meets Dolly Parton and falls apart. Beatty cringed when a super fag and his super ego spoke into the microphone, as if proclaiming his Latinidad and homosexualidad canceled out his excruciatingly obvious machismo. But really, you're just a domineering dick. let's not forget, baby wanted to say. Domineering dicks can be very, very completely gay. Being gay doesn't save you from being a patriarchal asshole. A Latin superego loved to talk about Gramsci and politics and HIV, and he built up gloriously intricate arguments, gleaming skyscraper arguments about decolonization and gay butt sex and the prison industrial complex and a fast forward and speedy construction, as if swift and quick political analysis absolved him of the very fact of his arrogance. It didn't, according to Baby. Latin superego is really just another queen who liked to lick his pretty lips and smile for the camera, wink, wink, and receive all the adulation and all the praise Baby tended to abhor. He'd wear his tiara and curtsy as he strutted down the catwalk in silver stilettos, candy-colored confetti, blooming and bursting and waving and grinning and sashaying down the aisle. Are we at a labor and feminism conference? Is this a critical ethnic studies symposium? Symposium, baby thought. Or are we at the catwalk for Comme des Garçons? Baby couldn't tell. It all seemed so confusing. The way people trumpeted their identities like fashion statements, flipping from one to the next to the next. The rotating wardrobe of empty jargon, each term out-trending the next. Mixing and matching queer and poly and woman and fag and women and mix. And cis and gendered and cis and C. She couldn't keep track. She couldn't keep track of the styles, the fads, the colors, the shapes, the sizes. She couldn't keep track of any of it. She wanted to be hip and rad and oh so progressive, but she didn't know how. She didn't know what to do. She didn't know what to say. She didn't think that wearing the right clothes. She didn't think she was wearing the right clothes to be truly down for the cause. Because didn't you need a perfect pair of clogs and a Che Guevara t-shirt? Didn't you need all that stuff? Didn't you need all that stuff to be really down for the cause? My, oh my, oh my. Baby needed to go shopping. She needed to look cute. She didn't need to craft her argument. She didn't need to sharpen her rhetorical skills. The Labor and Feminism conference opened at 7 p.m. and ended at 8 p.m. and the keynote began at 6 p.m. with Mr. Super Latin Super Ego slated to give the address. One, asshole. Part of Baby's trouble was that she didn't understand what it meant to be a victim. She was a victim. Really? But she didn't act like a victim, and she just certainly didn't dress like a victim, and she couldn't claim her victim nation, victimhood. She felt like she'd been hoodwinked into being a victim. She felt like she'd been hoodwinked into being something that she didn't understand, and she felt like being a victim was central to who she was, but she didn't know what it meant. She didn't know how to spell the word victim. She thought victim might mean victory. She thought victim might mean victorious. She thought victim might launch her into some sort of career driven by identity politics, driven by this victorious and victimhood, and she could wave the flag of her victim nation on on the steeple of the Church of Academia. And she could claim the tenure-track job and the six-figure salary that she wanted so desperately. If she could be a victim. If she could be a real capital V victim. If she could twist her identity into a perfect victim-y, oppressory soiree of victimization. But she didn't know how to do it. Because she didn't really know what a victim was. And so she scratched her head most evenings and typed a few words of her dissertation and wondered how she could make herself look a little more pathetic, a little more weak, a little cuter, a little softer. Tiara. Beattie believed that academic success had nothing to do with books or brains or an encyclopedic ability to trace the history of laissez-faire capitalism to the 5th century Etruscan Empire. It had nothing to do with Beattie's ability to talk the right talk. Note, a male colleague had written Beattie a scathing 10-paragraph email after drinks one evening after she, at the time, had offered a snooty proto-feminist cultural critique, but the sad truth was she had siphoned off the diatribe from bell hooks and spoke of it as her own, interjecting ideas like epistemologies of racism, machismo, then the logos of ovulation will surpass pedagogies of porn. But she didn't know what she was saying really deep down. She just thought it sounded good. She just thought it sounded smart. And her colleague didn't buy it. Page 2. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Mr. Latin superego with his grade A tenure track job and fancy publishers and conference talks galore. Yes, yes, yes. Mr. Latin superego was the keynote at a conference Beattie had been so eager to attend and colonize and dominate, though she was never close to being cast as the titular keynote speaker, Beattie did manage to sneak herself into a panel that would happen on Sunday at 3 p.m. in a damp, cobwebbed basement with a handful of pimply and pasty academic wannabe types who fumed at their lowly status within the castle, even after they'd published sparkling peer-reviewed papers, and even after they'd completed 5 million words for their dissertations, and even after they'd taken out boatloads of loans to complete their PhD. This was the prize. This was the prize. An audience of three sad-looking white boys crouched in the basement for some godforsaken panel. Yes. Story's over. I think the story's over. I think the story's over. And what does that mean for us? What does that mean for us? The story is over. The story is over. But it doesn't know if it's over. Because she's fucking crazy. The girl is fucking crazy. But why is she crazy? Why is she crazy? Why is she crazy? She's crazy because she lives in a fucking capitalist universe, which makes words commodities, which makes words currency, which makes words currency dripped in gold, which makes words cash in. Which makes words cash in. Cash in. Why can't baby cash in? Why can't baby cash in? Baby can't cash in because baby can't speak. Can't speak. Baby can't speak. Duh, you motherfuckers. Baby can't speak. I can't believe you fucking thought baby could speak. I can't believe you thought that I was fucking baby. Are you fucking retarded? Are you fucking retarded? I think you're fucking retarded. I do. I think you're fucking retarded. I think you are totally fucking retarded. And that's why you need to listen to some fucking Beyonce, motherfucker. Beyonce doesn't know how to speak. Beyonce is not a person. Beyonce is a cardboard cutout of a person. So let's just remember that. Let's just remember that when she walks in the room. We can't fucking take her seriously because Beyonce isn't human. She's a hologram. She's just a hologram. She's a sparkling hologram who walks across the stage. And we could try to think that she was something else other than a hologram, but she's not. She's a two-dimensional, non-person person who we love to walk, who we love to walk in our imaginations and believe that she's something else. Believe that she's real, believe that she's possible. Believe that she's not a figment of our imaginations. And she is. She really is. She's just a figment of our imagination. Where's Beyonce? I can't find Beyonce. Oh no. Where has Beyonce gone? Beyonce. Beyonce. Where have you gone? I can't find Beyonce. Where did Beyonce go? Is Beyonce real or is she not real? Is race real or is it not real? Is Donald Trump real or is he not real? Is this world going to hell or is it not going to hell? What is going on? What is going on? I think we don't know. Thank you. Baby says thank you.
him